Thanks very much. I hope you've all received a handout. There's one page of summary, and there are a couple of pages with textual material. When it comes to theories of causation, Greek medicine is a rich field that has much to offer to historians of philosophy, and that is probably well known to most people in this room, but it is a message that cannot be stressed enough. Greek doctors were among the first to apply, in a more or less systematic way, the search for causes for phenomena in the sphere of the body, health, and disease. Greek doctors were among the first to reflect on the notion, the very notion of cause, the concept of cause, to make distinctions between different types of causes, to make terminological distinctions between terms such as aitia and prophasis, aitia, aition, between external and internal causes, main causes, auxiliary causes, efficient final causes, evident and non-evident causes, preceding structural causes, and so forth. And Greek doctors were among the first to discuss the relevance, the importance, the modes, the possibilities, and also the appropriateness of causal explanation. The question to what extent causes can be known and how, the question to what extent causal connections can be empirically established, and the question to what extent causal explanation is in all cases possible, and even if it is possible, whether there's a point to it. So these are some of the issues that Greek medical writers were discussing in their writings, and that's why they're so important to the topic of this conference. What is of particular interest for us today, and also for the project on power structuralism in ancient ontologies, is the concept of power or capacity, dynamis. This concept plays a pivotal role in medical theories of causation. To express it in the vocabulary of the power structuralism project, powers are the dynamic building blocks of the reality of causal agency in processes of change in the body. And in this paper, I'd like to examine how some Greek medical authors conceived of these powers in their accounts of causal efficacy. And in particular, how they coped with two questions. One, the epistemological question as to how powers are known, how they are determined, and how claims about powers can be validated or falsified. And the ontological question about the nature and the unity of powers in the face of the plurality of the effects they are believed to bring about. Does one power always bring about the same effect, or are there different powers at work at the same time? What if a power is not effective? Is it still a power? Is dynamis just a relational term whose appropriateness varies from one case to another, or does it have an intrinsic value to it? So these are some of the issues that will occupy us. Now, when we talk about causes in medicine, there are three areas to which the medical writers turned their attention, and you can see them in the summary, the second paragraph, if you like. First, there is the area of the discussion of the causes of health and disease. And the causes of the nature of human beings. We've already seen some of that in the previous session. This includes things like material and formal causes, efficient as well as teleological causes of the structure of the body and parts of the body, the functioning of specific organs, and of course also the explanation of the occurrence of disease. And in this connection, to aitiologikon, or aitiologia, the Greek concepts, are used in ancient discussions to refer to one specific part of medicine that is concerned with causation. And in that field, the discussion of the causes of health and disease, the quest for these causes became a divisive issue, as some of you know very well, between the medical sects of the Hellenistic and early imperial periods. Speculation about non-evident causes, the adela aetia, became a distinctive characteristic of the so-called dogmatist or rationalist school of medicine. It was rejected by the empiricists, and in most cases also by the so-called methodists. The empiricists did engage in explanation by reference to evident causes, such as the well-known antecedent causes. And then there were people such as the pneumatist Dr. Athenaeus of Attalia, who developed distinctions between antecedent and structural causes, and the methodists, who seemed to do away with causal explanation altogether, because, they argued, it was of no relevance to treatment, although there is some evidence that they allowed causal explanation and even reference to what we would call non-evident causes under certain circumstances. These debates between the medical sects were also reflected in discussions about the origins, and that's my second item there, discussions about the origins or causes of the medical art as such, insofar as ideas about the quest for causes were retrojected onto the early history of medicine. For example, Hippocrates was claimed to have been the first systematizer of medicine, dividing medicine into different parts and insisting that medicine be based on the principles of natural philosophy, physica, which would include an account of the elements, the elementary qualities, and the powers. The quest for these, and the discoveries that were made during that quest, were believed to have led to the development of the medical art as it came about and was known at the time that these debates took place. But I'd like to turn and devote most of my attention today to the third area, the discussion of the causes of the dietetic and therapeutic effects of substances, foods, drinks, and drugs, or the effects of other modes of treatment. And this is the area of the so-called dynames, Latin facultates or virtutes, the powers of foods, drinks, drugs, and other modes of treatment to bring about certain changes in the body of the organism to which they are administered. What makes this area interesting and what distinguishes it from the other two, that the causes of health and disease and the causes of the art of medicine, is that in this domain, so therapeutic efficacy, there is at least an evident causal agent, or at least an evident carrier of, or a vehicle of therapeutic agency, namely the drug, or the food, or the drink, or the treatment, which is the aetion of the effect brought about, though it may still be unclear what the actual modus operandi of that effect is. It's an area where there seems to be greater scope for, if you like, causal manipulation by the doctor, not to mention the term experimentation, but I won't go into that. For while in the case of the causes of health and disease, the causal role of a specific factor, even if it is an observable factor, may easily escape notice. For instance, because by the time the doctor meets the patient, it is already unclear under exactly what events and circumstances the patient became ill. In the case of therapeutic intervention, there is at least potentially a more clearly definable set of conditions. A patient is suffering from a particular complaint, the doctor gives the patient a particular medicine, the patient's condition changes. And by repeating this treatment in a number of similar cases, by adjusting or varying the treatment, the dosage or the composition of the medicine from one case to another, a doctor may be able to develop and refine an understanding of the therapeutic efficacy of a particular treatment, get greater certainty about the causal powers and the way they work and the circumstances under which they work. And it is this kind of gradual refining, adjusting, trying, testing, repeating that we find, for instance, in Galen, when he's writing about his treatments of patients by means of various therapeutic modes in his therapeutic and pharmacological writings. And Galen uses words such as peirastai, dokimatsein, bazanistein, testing, trying, trying it out to see what changes if you raise the dosage or if you make some other changes to the treatment. So on the face of it, it looks as if there is a more a clearer set of conditions. But of course there are problematic issues here which Greek medical writers were well aware of. For there may be a question as to why the drug sometimes works and sometimes not. And if it works, in virtue of what features or properties it is efficacious? What causal role is played by other factors that have nothing to do with the properties of the drug as such, such as the environment or things in the body of the patient? And, of course, whether it is actually the drug that caused the change in the patient's body, or whether it was just a matter of coincidence. These are also issues raised, for instance, in the Hippocratic text on the art, Pyrotechnics. And, of course, we are only too aware of these discussions in the context of the placebo effect. And there are other issues, and I've spelled them out in the third section on page one of the handout. The determination of the dynamis, the relation between empirical trial and theoretical reasoning, the question to what extent we can retrospectively decide what the power of a substance is on the basis of the effects brought about. Questions about the one substance producing different effects under different circumstances. Does that mean there is a plurality of dynamis? Or is this to be understood in a different sense? If we allow for a plurality of different modi operandi, how can we find in virtue of what features a substance is effective in a particular case? How does the possibility of different modi operandi affect the question of the substance's dynamis? Is dynamis something that can be described in its own right, independent of its environment? Or is it always to be seen as a relational thing? Again, Galen would say something prosti, something in relation to something else. And another question, what does the causal account look like if the dynamis of a substance is not actualized? So these are some of the issues that arise even in the relatively clearly defined set of the discussion of the causes of the dietetic and therapeutic effects of substances. And we'll be looking at how a number of Greek doctors coped with these issues, and I've singled out three stages because it is a very schematic view of what was in reality a much more complicated story. But for practical reasons, I've decided to concentrate on three stages, some Hippocratic writers, Diocles, and then Galen. And perhaps that, just to put it against the background of a slightly wider context, and I think it was also raised last night and also this morning, I think one question that comes back is what's the use of the notion of dynamis in trying to make sense of all this? What do we gain by in understanding by attributing the effects of the of a therapeutic of a substance or a mode of treatment to something like a dynamis, and how do we justify such claims? Because, of course, the notion of dynamis, it is a very common word, of course, in Greek, power, the power to bring about certain changes in the body. It's not just a property or a feature, but it is something that is active, something that exercises power, and that exercises it with force, with force, iskus, varying degrees of force, as some of the texts point out. So what does it mean to invest a substance with power, especially also in the light of the incredible number of things that were invested with powers in Greek folklore, in magic, menstrual blood being invested with certain supposed powers, the urine of lynx being invested with certain powers. All that sort of lore was around in Greek and medical texts. And so a question arises as to some doctors like Galen trying to differentiate their own approach from these claims. How do they go about, and what do they do to make their claims about the supposed dynamis of substances plausible and meaningful and adding something to our understanding? So that's roughly at the back, the questions at the back of our minds when we start looking at the texts. And on the next couple of pages, we won't, of course, go through all this material, but I've printed some important primary sources that highlight several aspects of this, or cluster of issues. And I start with texts 2 and 3 from the Hippocratic corpus and from the 4th century writer Hesychius of Athens, because we're there in the domain of the features of foods and drinks and their supposed powers to bring about certain effects. And as I said, this notion of power, dynamis, it has always two sides to it, or at least two sides to it. First, the notion of potentiality, dynamis, it's something that is there as a potency, but it doesn't have to be exercised. There may be circumstances which somehow thwart the exercise of that potency. So it implies possible effects, but not necessarily fulfillment. And there is the other aspect, which I already mentioned, the relational aspects. Prosti, the effect a drug can have, clearly being dependent on the circumstances under which it is applied, the environment, and the nature of the body to which it is applied. And these potential effects are expressed in terms of heating, cooling, drying, moistening, but also in terms of being wholesome, being laxative, being diuretic, calming, soothing. There's a whole range of terms that are used to describe the dynamis of these substances. So let's have a look at some of the texts. In text 2 from the Hippocratic work Affections, I'll just read it out. Hot foods, if dry, are constipating, since they dry out the moisture in the cavity. But if moist, they moisten with their heat and promote evacuation. Sour foods dry, contract the body, and constipate. Sharp ones thin the body by causing irritation. Salty ones are laxative and diuretic. Those that are fat, rich, and sweet promote moistness and phlegm and strengthen. So there's a clear list here of foods that have certain properties, if you like, you know, dry, moist, sour, sharp, salty, fat, producing certain effects, relaxing, releasing urine, have a relaxing effect on the body, and so forth. And it is presented here as a clear correlation of the one, of the properties and their supposed effects. Text 3 goes even further than that, because it makes a generalizing claim. It says salty and sweet flavors all have a relaxing effect on the belly, while those that are acid and sharp release urine. Those that are bitter are rather diuretic, while some of them also have a relaxing effect on the belly. Those that are sour retain excretions. So there's, at least in the first part of this text, is a claim is made that that all these substances with these characteristics have that effect. And clearly the implication is that there is a correlation between having those properties and causing those effects. Now, such claims met, of course, with resistance, with criticism, and that's what we see in texts 4 and also text 1. Text 1 is not so much about foods and drinks, but about the causes of fever in this case, but the point is very similar. The author of On Ancient Medicine, who is very much concerned with causal explanation, argues against what he regards as simplistic, too crude, too simplifying causal accounts. And he says it's not simply through heat that people get fever, nor is it the only cause of feeling unwell. Rather, it is the combination of bitterness and heat, or sharpness and heat, or saltiness and heat, and innumerable other things. And again, the combination of cold with other properties. And this notion of a combination, a cluster of things that all together, as it were, form the causal factors that lead to a certain effect, is echoed by other authors, which we'll see in a moment. Text 4 from On Regimen, which we've already heard about this morning, goes a bit further. That author, who produces a long list of foods and drinks with their dietetic effects, argues against what he calls all those who have undertaken to give a generalizing account about the power of foods and drinks that are sweet or fatty or salt or any other of such nature. Why are they wrong, he says? For the foods and drinks that are sweet do not all have the same power, dynamis, nor is this the case with the fatty or any other such things. How does he prove this claim? He says some sweet foods and drinks are laxative, others are stopping, yet others are drying, yet others moistening. And in the same way, those that are heating and all the others, some have this power, some have another. And it is impossible to give a general account, cuff hollow, log on, of how these things are. What power each of them individually has, I will set forth. So he argues against people who claim either implicitly or explicitly a causal connection between having a certain quality like fatty or salty and having a certain power, where here is already a distinction implied between having these properties like being salty or sweet or whatever, and having a power, namely being laxative, stopping, drying, moistening. So some differentiation of categories is already emerging there. And that is also exactly the distinction that Diocles makes in text number 6, an important fragment of Diocles, who lived about a generation later than Hippocrates, contemporary of Aristotle. And Diocles in that fragment also deals with I said substances, but it's clear that he's thinking about foods and drinks, maybe also drugs, and where he's also polemically arguing against people who make false correlations. Look what the text says, very similar to text 4. Those then who suppose that substances that have similar flavors or smells or degrees of hotness or some other quality of this kind all have the same powers, dynames, are mistaken. Why? For it can be shown empirically that from substances that are similar in these respects, many dissimilar effects result. So he's just falsifying it with empirical evidence. And indeed, he says, one should also not suppose that every substance that is laxative or promotes urine or has some other power is like that for the reason that it is hot or cold or salt. So it goes one step further. People who argue that it is because of being hot or cold or salt that they have those powers, again, refutation by an appeal to the empirical evidence, seeing that not all substances that are sweet or pungent or salt, or those having any other quality of this kind, have the same powers. So what is the right approach? Rather, he says, one must think that the whole nature, holē physis, is the cause of whatever normally results from each of them. It's a bit obscure what that means. I think what he means is the whole nature of the substance. And it's a bit along the same lines as the text number one, the combination. So the whole nature of a substance, the whole nature of garlic or onions or vinegar or whatever, that is what needs to be regarded as the cause. So that is that puts Diocles, as it were, on a par with the author of On the Regimen in text number 4. But I think he also goes one step further, and to appreciate that we have to have a quick look at text number 5, because that's the same author on Regimen from the Hippocratic Corpus, who, although he's just criticized people who give generalizing causal accounts, goes about it in his own way by explaining the effects of certain substances with reference to other features they have. And I've just listed some examples. Maza cools because it is moistened with cold water. It passes because it is soon digested. And it passes because it is mixed with the sweet and laxative part of the wheat. Boiled down wine warms, blah, 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 also because it is boiled down. And fourth example, it promotes stools and urine because of the purgative qualities that it possesses. So there's a question there of what these explanations actually explain, because they only seem to shift the explanandum to something else, which is supposed to have these powers. But it doesn't add anything. And the last example is also interesting. When preserved in vinegar, these meats are less warming because of the vinegar. There is something tautological about these explanations. And that is what Diocles may be criticizing in the second part of his text, which we won't read in its entirety because of time. But in that section, he is criticizing people who believe one should always state a cause why a certain substance produces a certain effect. And the gist of what he says there is, you know, sometimes it's just not necessary, but in other cases it may not just be possible to explain, because you go around in circles and you don't add any new information to your causal account. So we see Diocles, as I say, one generation later than these Hippocratic writings, warning against premature generalizations, and especially against misidentification of the causal agent in processes of alteration. We also see him using empirical evidence to refute certain of these causal claims by pointing out that various substances with the same qualities produce different effects. And that is a technique that we also see in other authors, and also in Galen, inferring the presence of a certain power from the effect cause, and inferring the absence of a certain power from the absence of the effect cause. So the determination of the dynamis of a substance on the basis of the effects that follows. And there is a question there as to whether that's, of course, a valid mode of reasoning. Because we can imagine various scenarios. We can imagine the explanatory scenario of a substance, say honey, producing a certain effect, say heating, due to its capacity, its dynamis, to cause heating. And we can imagine that's smoothly taking place without any interference of other factors. But we could also imagine a scenario in which a substance, say honey, produces a certain effect, for instance heating, but not because of its capacity to heat, but because of a combination of other factors and circumstances. So the capacity to heat may not be realized, but heating may still take place as a result of other factors. And in this case, inferring the presence of the capacity to heat from the occurrence of heating may be factually correct, but it may not apply in the case under consideration, even though the capacity to heat is present in substance A. It wasn't due to that capacity that heating took place. And there's a third scenario one can imagine, in which a substance is applied. Say honey is used, the effect heating takes place, but where the coming to be of the heating is not due to the honey, to the substance A, and has nothing to do with the fact that substance A, honey, has certain features and qualities. And in that case, inferring the presence of the capacity to heat from the occurrence of heating would be wrong, because there's nothing in substance in the substance that contributes to that effect. So these are some sort of theoretical considerations which are taken up by Galen a couple of centuries later. And I moved on the handout now to the section on Galen. And most of my textual material is taken from three Galenic treatises that are very important for this subject matter. One is his work De Alimentorum Facultatibus, The Powers of Foods. Then there is his general work on simple drugs, The Powers and Mixtures of Simple Drugs. And the third work that is very important here is book three of his work, De Temperamentis, Mixtures. And we see Galen concerned with, again, coming back to the division I made in the beginning between, on the one hand, the epistemological side of things, and on the other hand, the ontological side of things. First, the epistemology, the determination. How do we find out what dynamis a substance has? How do we determine the power, the capacity of a substance? Now, Galen is confident, in Galen there's always this combination of reason and experience, logos and empiria, or peira, test, empirical trial, that have to be combined in certain ways in order to bring about secure results. In some cases, Galen is quite confident that the powers of certain substances can be empirically determined by the sense of touch, to which he pays great importance. But he also addresses concerns and queries raised by other thinkers who point to counter-evidence, or alleged counter-evidence, that is in conflict with what Galen has been arguing. And Galen refers in those connections often to his notion of what in Greek is dihorismene peira, so a trial or an experiential trial that is that is provided with dihorismoi, qualifications or specifications, definitions of the circumstances under which a particular trial has to take place. And that is what he refers to texts 9, 10, 11 and 12. I won't read that all, but you can get a sense of what he is getting at. For instance, text 10, one cannot forgive doctors who leave many of their most useful theoretical points without qualification, ane dihorismu. For they should not state without qualification that rockfish are easily digestible for most people, although some people are found to digest beef more easily, but one should qualify both groups, dihorisdein. Just as with honey, one should not make statements without qualification, but with the addition, prosthesinai is the word he uses there, you need to add to which age groups and which natural constitutions it is beneficial or harmful, and in which seasons or places or modes of life. And he makes a similar point in text 11. When performing the tests, this is the test, the trial, the batanos, accurately by means of qualified experience, which we have discussed many times before, we will discover the medicinal power of wormwood from its mixture itself. For if one crushes the foliage together with the flowers, for the rest of the fruit is useless, and applies it to a clean wound, it turns out to be pungent and irritating. But if you want to soak it in olive oil and pour it over the head or down the stomach, it will be found to be intensely heating. So interestingly, the effect will be quite different depending on how you prepare it and how you apply it. That is one side of the coin, the epistemological conditions that have to be fulfilled for an empirical trial to be really secure and have an evidential value. But I turn now to the ontological aspects, and that is from texts number 15 onwards, because that's probably the most interesting for today's purpose. So what is actually a dynamis? What is it? What should we think? In what terms should we think about it? Galen defines it as a kind of readiness, an epitedeiotes, a suitability. So it's there in the substance under consideration. It is a certain mode of being ready to be actualized. In text number 15, the underlined bit, incapacity, that's our translation, that's Peter's translation for dyname, which we've long thought about, that we've decided to translate it as incapacity and dyname. It's something incomplete, still going to be so, and as it were tending to come about, but not yet being what it is said to be. For the infant is not yet rational, but is going to become so, nor is a newborn dog yet a hunter, but it is called so by virtue of its ability to hunt if it reaches its completion. And a bit further down, these drugs are not yet completely hot, but they have to a high degree a tendency, again this notion of tendency, to become hot, and because of that they are referred to as hot in capacity. In the third section of text number 15, things whose actual nature arrives at its completion in the absence of any external factor preventing it. Medanos exosen empodon gignomenu is the Greek and Aristotelian formula that Galen applies a number of times. Nothing external preventing it, then it's come to its completion. So it is in the nature of a substance to become such and such, to actualize its nature, unless something external prevents it. So this readiness, this epitelios, is an actually present state. It's not just something that exists in the mind of the doctor or pharmacologist. It's something physically there. And as such, it has an existence of its own. And Galen develops that concept I've selected a couple of passages from Mixtures where he develops that notion. Sometimes it takes a bit of time for a capacity to be actualized, to be activated. Sometimes it needs a bit of help and assistance, but it is there, and it's certainly its natural tendency to be fulfilled. Galen also discusses the various modes under which such a capacity can be actualized. And, for instance, in text number 18, he makes quite an important distinction in his pharmacological work between substances that act in virtue of their whole substance, kath holen ten usian, reminds a bit of what we just heard from Diocles, and substances that act in virtue of any one of their qualities, kath kata mian or kata hentina mian, poioteta is in the term he uses. So he makes a distinction between various, this is the notion of modus operandi. Sometimes a drug works in virtue of its whole substance. So you need to take the whole configuration of components, elements, mixtures into account. But sometimes also it works just in virtue of one specific property it has. And that is a distinction that is, again, a distinction that is out there in the reality of the substance, and that needs to be taken into account, and that can also be actually determined by the pharmacologist. But Galen also tries, obviously, to come to terms with the empirical reality of one substance producing different effects under different circumstances. And how does he do that? And how does he, what consequences does that have for this notion of a dynamis as a natural suitability actualizing itself unless an external agent interferes? Well, several passages illustrate several aspects of his approach. And basically I still haven't really got to a firm conclusion about this, but there seems to be a kind of double-sidedness in Galen between this view of a dynamis as something that under normal conditions fulfills itself, on the one hand, and a dynamis as something relational that depends for its realization entirely on the circumstances, the external circumstances to which it is applied. And there are these two tendencies in Galen, and he doesn't quite succeed in come to a clear resolution. Look at text number 19. Coriander consists of opposite powers, enantiae dynames. It has much bitterness, which was shown to reside in its fine and earthy texture, but it has also the power to produce quite a bit of watery, fatty moisture, and it has also something astringent. So in one substance, there are more than one, even opposite powers, dynames. One and the same substance, text 21, 22, 23, can act as a nourishment, as a drug, or even as a poison. So again, so a nourishment is a trophe, a drug is a pharmakon, a poison is a deleterion. So one and the same substance can act either as the one or the other or the third, depending on the circumstances, depending on the mode of application. You know, whether you take it in through the mouth or on the skin, whether you prepare it boiled or crude, whether you chop it up in smaller pieces or swallow it as one piece and so forth. So there's a whole list of factors that Galen mentions to be taken into consideration, and that matter for the effect that the drug is, that the substance is going to bring about. One and the same food may provide the function of both nourishment and drug to an animal. That's a point. And that's, again, something that Galen hammers in opposition to other people, he quotes in the course of his argument, who've been raising objections to Galen's ground. You know, Galen, what about this? You know, we tried this substance and these effects came about. Doesn't that contradict your theory? Galen says, no, it doesn't, because you have to think of this and that distinction. Text number 24 makes the point about the mode of preparation very important, and the mode of administration. Some drugs, which are innocuous when applied externally, cause great harm if drunk. Pretty obvious points, but Galen is making them, as I say, in opposition to rival groups that he quotes from time to time. And this idea of a substance producing different effects under different circumstances is summed up, if you like, in text number 25, where this relational aspect of dynamis is once again emphasized. And I'll just read the first section of that. One must therefore both understand and test what is hot in its capacity and not yet so in its activity in a multiplicity of ways. And therefore those are wrong who think that because something is not readily inflammable, that is, it is not hot in capacity, even in relation to us. For if it undergoes coction easily and nourishes quickly, then it must be hot in relation to us, cross hemas. And if it heats and administered as a drug, this too must be hot in capacity in relation to humankind, cross anthropus. And so in the case of every species of animal, what is hot in its capacity, whether as a drug or as a nourishment, is said to be so in relation to that animal only. For every possession of a quality in capacity consists in a relation to something. With a very clear, emphatic statement of this relational aspects of the notion of dynamis. So I'll try to wrap up now. So there is there are two sides to Galen's approach to the dynamis of substances. On the one hand, there is this idea of what you might call an essentialist concept of the dynamis of substances, an actually existing physical state that can be described as a natural tendency and that will, under normal circumstances, develop into a state that can be described as the actualization, the energia, or the activation of the power or potentiality. And there, this condition under normal circumstances, nothing external interfering, suggests that is indeed the natural course of action. On the other hand, there is this more relational or relativistic approach to the concept of dynamis, where the effect seems entirely dependent on the outcome of the test in a particular causal chain. So what effect a substance has depends on on a large number of factors that you need to take into account. The definition of what that dunam is, of that substance then is, becomes a rather complicated business. On the first view, it is a relatively straightforward account. One would have to say that certain substances have a natural tendency to behave in a certain way, that is, to produce certain effects, and hence they can be assumed to possess the dunamis to produce these effects. That is, the production of such an effect is not due to incidental variable circumstances. But on the other relativist or relational point of view, such a unitary concept of dunamis doesn't seem to apply. One either has to assume a plurality dunamis, as the example of coriander seemed to suggest, a plurality of dunamis in the same substance, or one has to assume a more complicated combined definition of the dunamis, the power to produce this or that effect under such and such circumstances, where one would have to spell out in great detail what these effects under these different circumstances are, in combination with certain factors, when applied to people of a certain age group, or with a particular constitution, etc. And the account of these circumstances would be provided by going through the list of the diorismoi, the qualifications, or the specifications that Galen says are important also to take into account when you go about empirically testing a particular drug. So, really, that's, I think, what I had to say. Thank you very much.